Afghanistan. This is what we're going to be talking about a little bit here at the Sarah Carter Show today. Thank you so much for joining me. Remember, you can see all of our latest stories, breaking stories on sarahacarter.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carter DC. I'm here at beautiful Radio America at the studios with Jenny Terre and Adam. And Adam, the mooch.
Hi, everyone.
I'm going to throw that out. I'm going to do this. This is a very serious topic, and I don't think people are talking about it enough, mainly because, let's just start off the top. I mean, everybody's focused on the presidential election, 2020, November. This is the biggest deal right now in our nation, right? So everybody's focused on what's going to happen here, what's going to happen with the election, how are we going to handle this? I have two amazing guests on today. They're a powerhouse couple, powerhouse conservative couple. I have Matt Schlapp, who is the chair of the American Conservative Union CPAC and Conservative Political Action Conference. It's coming up. The CPAC conference is going to be coming up. And I have Mercedes Schlapp, who is right now working with Donald Trump's campaign and Vice President Mike Pence's campaign on strategy. So she's like a head strategist. She's also working with the Hispanic community and is a strategist reaching out to the Hispanic community across the United States. She and I actually have something in common. We are both we have family from Cuba. She is a second generation Cuban American. She is an American, but speaks Spanish beautifully and spends a lot of time in the communities, both in Miami and Miami, Florida, and throughout the United States doing outreach. So they have a great interview with me, and it's so funny, and you guys got to hear it, because they were actually on their way to a small family vacation when I called them, and I had them both in the car on their cell phones with their kids and the dogs. So I love them very much. Thank you so much for taking your time to talk to us, to talk to our listeners about what's happening. And by the way, we're breaking news. We do have breaking news. Matt Schlapp confirmed something huge about CPAC. So keep on listening and you will hear what he has to say. And it's not even a hint. It's straight up. He broke it on the Sarah Carter Show. But I want to go back to Afghanistan. And this is so important to me. And I know it's important to our listeners. I want you to think about the longest war. 18 years. Thousands of people who've lost their lives. Our military forces there on the ground, and the thousands that have been injured, like my husband, Marty, who lost his eyesight, and others who have lost their legs, lost their arms, PTSD. I can go on and on and on. And what does that mean to us as Americans? A lot of us who were there on September 11th, who remember that, who are old enough to remember what happened that day, remember what Al-Qaeda did and how they planned this attack. They had safe harbor in Afghanistan. If some of us remember Tora Bora and the fight we had there against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and how they moved across the mountain way, you know, across the ridge into Pakistan, and how it took forever for us to get Osama bin Laden in Pakistan in that operation under President Obama. A very successful operation that took out Osama bin Laden. But the reason why we're there and why we've been fighting, and for a lot of us, and especially young people, they're just exhausted of it. They're like, why are we there? And even people within our administration now, why are we still there? Why are we still fighting in Afghanistan after we've seen all of these reports from, you know, the inspector general about hundreds of millions of dollars wasted, billions actually, in the fight there, loss of life? What's the win for us in the graveyard of empires? Well, I spent a lot of time, and I've told you this before on the show, I spent a lot of my career in Afghanistan with our troops on the front line, many times in Pakistan, right along the Pakistani border. I also spent time in Pakistan and traveled into the federally administered tribal belt, a very lawless region that divides both Pakistan and Afghanistan from one another. It's an area where the Taliban calls home, and a lot of the insurgency calls home. It's very difficult for us to access that region of the world. You know, the Hindu Kush. People hear about these things, but they don't imagine. When I flew in into that region with the Pakistan army and military, I realized what we were up against. An insurgency is so much, so far different than what we were used to in World War II or World War I. You don't have tank divisions. You're not fighting on these battle lines. You know, you're fighting farmers who, during the day, they're farming their land, and at night, they become insurgents. You have people passing messages. Our guys are on the front lines, you know, in their uniforms, in their, you know, vehicles. It's pretty evident who they are when they're out on the front lines, but it's never evident who the enemy is. The enemy could be, you know, the teenage guy that's like selling bread on the side of the road, or a little kid who's asked to, you know, relay messages in between villages. You just never know. It's a different world. And it became a different war for us, fighting Al-Qaeda, fighting Islamic State, fighting extremist groups, because they have no real country. Their ideas, they're based on an ideology. So now I'm taking you into Afghanistan with me. It's like the very first time I went into the country. I was flying over the country in a C-130, and I was with some troops leaving the Persian Gulf, and we were coming in the early morning hours as the sun was rising above the mountains. It was the most beautiful, picturesque vision that I can explain to you. To see the sun rise and to see these mountains with their jagged edges piercing up from the earth, and these little villages dotted across the landscape. And when I first got there, it was almost like stepping in to the past. Right, yeah, it was like stepping into the past. I was literally 2,000 years ago. That's what it felt like. Where people were isolated from the rest of the world, you had villages that really hadn't seen foreign fighters since the Russians were there. Some of them actually thought some of our U.S. soldiers were actually Russian. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't even know that Al-Qaeda had targeted the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. They didn't know any of this. What they did know was that their country was in a chokehold, especially people in the north, by the Taliban, that had controlled the region with such fierceness and such rule of law under Islamic Sharia law. And it was an overly stringent type of hold that they had on the people there, that they were suffering. Their children couldn't go to school, especially the young girls. The country was mainly uneducated. I think over 90% in some areas couldn't even read or write and still can't. There was no electricity. They got their water from the wells at like 4 a.m. in the morning. You'd see the children already getting up and walking towards the wells with their buckets to just get water to bring back to their kalats. Kalats are like little enclosed homes with a wall around them, usually made out of mud, where the entire family lives. And you'll never see the women, because the women usually are not allowed outside of their kalats. It's an ancient way of living. Even their agriculture was very similar, the way they grew grapes. And I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, on these, not on trestles, but on little mounds. You know, when I would go out to the rice fields and I would see older men in these beautiful fields of rice, and, you know, the wind whipping across the rice, you know, the tall grass in the rice fields, it almost looked like an ocean swaying back and forth. It was so incredibly beautiful. I'm taking you there for 1 minute because I want you to understand what we are up against. We now have a deal to trade Taliban prisoners for Afghan prisoners. President Donald Trump wants an end to this war, and I know why. He doesn't know what our national security interest is there. He wants to reduce troop size or get out altogether. Within this ancient land, though, resides a very complex geopolitical system. You have Pakistan, India, Russia, China. Everybody wants a little piece of Afghanistan. And the people there are highly divided tribes. And then you have a central government that, for the most part, has been corrupted ever since we've been there. So it's completely complex. There's nothing simple about Afghanistan. There's nothing simple about us being there. There's nothing simple about us leaving there. And even now, I've been talking to sources on the ground there. Al-Qaeda and foreign fighters have moved their way back in. They're living within villages, quietly keeping on the down low with the hope that we do pull out and that the Taliban once again takes control of Kabul. And if we do pull out completely, I've talked to people about this. I'm giving it 1 week. Now, what is our national security interest in this ancient place, this land that most of us before September 11, 2001, didn't even know where it was on a map? Unless you were an archaeologist or somebody who understood the world or geography.
I still don't know what's ancient about it. Why is it so important?
It's so important. Well, it's innate. Well, let me start off. You have two questions there, Adam. One is that it's an ancient place because it doesn't have access to the outside world so much. Kabul was really the capital of Kabul was really the only place in that entire region that had access to the outside world. So most of the people live in villages in these mountains. You know, lived the same way they lived thousands of years ago. There just wasn't a lot of investment. And remember, Afghanistan has been ripped apart since the British Empire, which is called the graveyard of empires because all the British died. And then you have, you know, the Russians who went in the 80s. And of course, us with the CIA. Everybody knows that story. I don't need to reiterate that. Our Stinger missiles, our help with the Great Massoud and the Afghan insurgency at the time. And we were able to push, basically, the Russians economically couldn't afford to fight there. And that's what we're facing now, too. How much investment are we going to put into this country and for what purpose? And how many more lives lost?
I mean, these are things I just don't think people know.
I know. I don't think they understand either. It's just a different world. But remember, it became a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. And this is what we don't want to happen again. And it's not easy to trust the Taliban. In fact, I did send a message to the Taliban before we went on the air and asked for comment to see exactly what it is and if they're in agreement with this peace process. You always have to ask these questions. I haven't heard back yet, but I usually do. I usually get a statement. I spent a lot of years there, so I know who to contact. So now we're between a rock and a hard place. You know, General Jack Keane said on Fox News, and this I agree with him with, there's a healthy dose of skepticism here. Can we really pull out? Can the Taliban abide by the rules of the peace deal? We don't know. They have never done so in the past. Usually when the Taliban hears we're going to pull out, or usually when there's a peace deal on the table, something goes sideways and the Taliban usually re-ups their attacks. Now, this peace deal is very important and the time frame of it, because usually when the Taliban decides to start attacking, it's usually in the spring. The weather gets better and we see a surge in attacks in the spring. And in the summer, we could see a consistent fighting force. And then in the fall, it goes back up again. So there's two areas, and it's mainly because of the weather, because it can get extraordinarily hot there. And in the winter, it can be very cold. It could get to the point where you just can't even fight. The mountains are covered with snow. So we have to ask ourselves, what is going to be the best strategy to stop these insurgencies or these terrorist organizations from once again reforming and targeting our nation again? Do we need to have troops on the ground in Afghanistan? Massive troops. I would say no. But I would say that we need some kind of force to target Al-Qaeda or to target any other insurgency, even Islamic State or others, so that they can't rise again. And that's probably what the president is looking at now. He's probably deciding, like, how do we have... A friend of mine once called it the lily pad strategy. You know, how do we have a lily pad where we can say, okay, we see Al-Qaeda reformulating in the ground in Afghanistan. How can we get back in there and target them? You know, again, without sending a full load of troops to the ground, battalions, you know, where we're not putting all of our men on the front line, where we're trying to rebuild a nation because we don't want to rebuild a nation anymore. We're done with nation building. We're done with nation building. We've seen what happened, and that's because they did not have a strategy. There was no real clear strategy in Afghanistan. In fact, anytime they had a strategy, it changed every 6 months with the new leadership. And it's been 18 years of that. 18 years. And they don't want to do it anymore. But we can't just walk away altogether. That's not the smart thing either. There has to be something in the middle. And I think that's what's important here. We have to look at it and we have to decide for ourselves what's worth the risk. And how do we mitigate that risk? And how do we make it in our best national security interest? And that's why I brought this up. I mean, I'm going to talk a lot more about Afghanistan as we go on. In our podcast, because I think it's going to be important. And if I get an opportunity, I may be heading back there sometime this year. That would be important to me because we should know what are the risks to our own national security and how does this affect me? So I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on from Afghanistan a little bit. I want to talk quickly about John Brennan. I wanted to let you know he's under the Department of Justice scrutiny, according to sources I've spoken with and other reports out there. John Durham, who was appointed by Attorney General William Barr, is now looking very closely at John Brennan. Apparently, he has all of John Brennan's back and forth emails, and this deals with directly the intelligence assessment that was conducted by John Brennan and released in January 2017. Remember, this is the assessment that John Brennan said they had information that Donald Trump, that the Russians wanted Donald Trump to win and that they did not want Hillary Clinton to win. So there were people that disputed that when that intelligence assessment came out. And now it looks like, based on Michael Horowitz's Inspector General report, it sure looks like John Brennan lied before Congress when he said he did not use, this is what he said, he did not use Christopher Steele's dossier in that intelligence assessment. But he did, according to the Inspector General's report. And I think that's something that they need to investigate because that dossier has been debunked. He's a former British spy, and the sources in that dossier were former Russians who probably wanted to spread disinformation. So guess what? If that's the case, John Brennan and the Obama administration got played by Russia, not Donald Trump. And that's pretty sad. So we're going to do that. We talked a little bit about that. I got just a whole slew of things here. I don't want to go through every single one. Oh, yeah. So nice. I know I'm probably, I didn't talk to Matt about this. We talked about so much else. But yeah, Mitt Romney, you are still not invited to CPAC. But apparently it was because of physical safety. Like they were worried that if Mitt Romney went, people would be so angry. They would what? Throw a tomato at him? I don't know, Jenny.
I thought they just didn't have wheelchair ramps.
Oh, That may be it. Another thing I want to talk to you really quick before we move on to Mercedes and Matt is the DOJ has sought a continuance of the Flynn case. In fact, what the DOJ has done, these prosecutors against Lieutenant General Michael Flynn have actually sought a continuance of the Flynn case basically to vindicate Michael Flynn's former lawyers who basically didn't do their job. Flynn withdrew his guilty plea. Sidney Powell's his new lawyer right now. You guys got to read this story. It's the DOJ sought continuance of Flynn case to vindicate the public reputation of his former legal team. An important story. You will see it at sarahacarter.com. Go there and read that story because it's going to open your eyes to what's happening here with Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. And guess what? There is a good chance his case is going to get thrown out. There is a good chance that Michael Flynn will be vindicated. Sidney Powell's done an incredible job. So now let me get going. We have got Mercedes Schlapp and Matt Schlapp. the powerhouse conservative couple here on the show with us today. They have so much to tell you. We're going to be breaking news, folks, on this show. And I've got Matt Schlapp from the American Conservative Union. He's the chair there. And Mercedes Schlapp, who is a chief strategist for President Donald Trump's campaign, and she is also a chief strategist working on Hispanic issues and talking to the Hispanic community. And you're going to love this interview. Let's take a ride to the farm with Matt and Mercedes, the kids and the dog. So we're on the air now, and I got to let everybody know what's happening here. I'm going to set the scene for you. We are on vacation with Matt Schlapp and Mercedes Schlapp. They are in the car. They are driving to their beautiful, secluded, I'm not even going to say where, place, a farm that nobody else is invited to because the family wants to be alone. But I'm interrupting their vacation. They're with their beautiful children and their dogs. So when they start talking to us and we hear the background noise, that's what you're going to be hearing. And it's totally fine with me. In fact, it's awesome because I'm a family person too, and I usually have my husband, the kids, and the dogs with us as well.
It's like we're in the van.
It's like we're in the van with the Schlapps, with the powerhouse couple from Washington, D.C. This is the conservative powerhouse couple who I've already introduced you to, but want to introduce you again. First of all, hi, Matt. Hi, Mercedes. Hi, kids. Hi, dogs.
Hello, Sarah.
Hi. So this is probably going to be one of the most important elections of our lifetime. And that's what I keep hearing from everyone. It's going to be a shift in our nation like we've never seen before, even more so than 2016. And mainly, I think it's because of all of the information that we've been privy to over the last 3 years. And we've seen this intense push by the left, by the Democrats, to try to target President Trump, target his voters, target the people in the White House. And Mercedes, I'm going to start with you, because I've never had you on the show before, and Matt and I talk all the time in the green room, and I never get a chance to talk to you personally, but you're right now the strategist for President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence's team, and you're also the head of Latino Outreach, something which we have in common, that we both have Cuban ancestry and family. Can you talk a little bit about what this means for you, this election?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having us on the show. And I'm glad that I can join you all the first time, me and the two English lads and all the children in the car. So I'll tell you, we're at a critical moment right now where, you know, the president was able to survive Russian collusion, survive the obsession of the impeachment. And it actually backfired because we've been able to raise so much money off of in terms for the campaign because of the impeachment sham. So really, we're in a strong position in terms of the resources we have, the investments we're making on the ground. Matt and I had just come back from New Hampshire following the New Hampshire primary. The energy there, the Trump supporters are out in full force, and they want this president to get reelected. You know, but the reality exists that while we still are seeing a chaotic process on the left, where, you know, they can't count votes in Iowa. There's nervousness surrounding the Nevada caucus as well. They're embracing, you know, literally their base is embracing a socialist. And then you have Michael Bloomberg, who wants to basically buy the race and buy the election and buy the Democrat National Committee. You know, we have to keep our eye on the ball. We have to realize that this is not going to be just an easy race to win, an easy election to win for this president. It is going to take every single one of us out there to activate, to get involved, to volunteer in the president's campaign, because these Democrats will do whatever they can with all the resources to beat this president, and we just cannot be asleep on the wheel.
Right. You don't want to underestimate your opponent ever. And I think that we saw them learn that lesson, and I'm talking about the Democrats in 2016, and we saw that the full year before, where every time a pundit would get on television and President Trump's name would be mentioned, they would laugh it off, right? They would say, oh, there's no way, he's never going to be president. Of course, They had egg on their face on election night, and Hillary Clinton had to basically get her refund on her curtains for the White House because that wasn't happening. And but one of the things I wanted to say was about Bloomberg. Bloomberg is now planning on just going for superdelegates. We realize that. But he also made an announcement that he is considering bringing Hillary Clinton on as his vice president. What went through your mind, Mercedes, when that announcement was made? And I know I've heard so many people call in, write in, talk about this issue. What does this mean overall? Does it require a different strategy as far as the White House, when the possibility that Bloomberg could just go in, buy up all the delegates, you know, end up being the candidate, and then bring in Hillary Clinton as a vice president?
You know, for us, it doesn't change the strategy in the sense that we really feel that the president is unbeatable, in the sense that he's in a very strong position. You know, with that being said, it's sort of the bring it on. We know Hillary Clinton lost because the mere fact that they're trying to resurrect her again, despite the fact that there's Hillary fatigue. I mean, these Democrats don't want Hillary to come back. I mean, she ran for office. She failed miserably. And she is just not a likable candidate in any way. So it's actually quite shocking that Bloomberg would want to go with what I would say that, you know, the 1990s politicians, you know, the
right.
It just makes no sense to us that he would want to go backwards and just seek this Democrat establishment individual that has no almost connection with where the Democrat Party is going.
Absolutely. Matt, how do you feel about that? I mean, what's your sense? And as far as, like, we see Bernie Sanders now and his supporters just up in arms over this because they feel like, okay, once again, the Democrats are going to rob us of our opportunity, to speak out. And obviously, Mercedes, I know you have a lot of thoughts about that as a socialist, his socialist platform, me as well. But we're seeing this across the board, across the Democrats moving so far to the left. But they also want to try to, you know, those that have the money want to steal that from the Democratic Party and put what they consider their moderates in. How do you feel about that, Matt?
Well, I think it's great that Michael Bloomberg is looking for a young whippersnapper like Hillary Clinton to be on the ticket with him, because, I mean, that's generational change when you're, you know, a man in your 80s or near 80s. You know, I think it's interesting that the youth and vitality of the Democratic Party. I'm really enjoying Bernie take on Bloomberg, take on Biden. This is really the voice of a next generation. It's the voice of the 1930s, actually. But
right.
And I think that they, you know, they've got a big problem because, you know, they're all about class warfare and demonizing the 1%. They're actually into demonizing the 50% because they call us all deplorables. And, you know, Bernie Sanders was denied the nomination last year because the Clintons effectively ran the party through Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which Donna Brazile talks about in her book. It's a fact. It happened. It was hashtag rigged. The president was right to say that. And if it looks like Bernie is denied again because they start changing the rules and Bloomberg's out there buying it, which he is already trying to do, I just, Sarah, for the first time, I can tell you, I don't see Democrats coming back together in this coalition. I think it's going to break it up. And they might think they have a candidate in Michael Bloomberg that's a better general election candidate, but without the base of their party fired up, we could see an overwhelming loss if they can't come back together again.
Well, I've been saying this from the beginning, that the Democratic Party is so fractured. It's so fractured. And even though they've stuck on point with the most ridiculous, strategies, which was trying to impeach President Trump or going after him on the Russia hoax. I mean, it was really behind the worst of the worst. It was, you know, Adam Schiff or Gerald Nadler or Nancy Pelosi being strong-armed by the squad, you know, Rashida Tlaib and the Ilhan Omars and, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But when you really look deep into the Democratic Party, there was really nothing there. They're completely fractured, which is quite the opposite of the Republican Party now, where we feel this surge, this connection across the country, this need to see. And I mean, I have talked to voters across the country. I know you have too, Matt, where you see this movement where people are like, no, I'm going to get up off my couch on election in November, on election night. I'm going to put in my vote because it's going to have to count. It has to count, or otherwise our nation will be changed. And I think coming up to CPAC, which is so important, are you feeling that same kind of surge within the Republican Party, within the conservative movement?
Well, let's just be clear here. Polling data demonstrates that Republicans and conservatives have never been so united. Let me repeat that sentence. Never been so united. Never been this united, even under Ronald Reagan. So Republicans and conservatives are pretty happy with what President Trump has done. And the American people generally, if you look at consumer confidence, if you look at whether or not they think the country's going in the right direction, people generally are more positive today than any day in the Obama presidency. So the numbers, prove that out. And as far as CPAC is concerned, a bit like the president's rallies, we've never sold out of tickets like we have sold out for this year's CPAC. We thought last year's CPAC was a monster in terms of people's demand to be there, but this year is even more. And we got some surprises in the room to try to cram even more people in there. And our international conservatives around the world and people all over the country are going to be watching online. And I think it's really, Sarah, CPAC is going to be great because it's going to be right up opposite the Democratic primary in South Carolina. And I think it's the official start of the presidential campaign.
Wow, the official start of the presidential campaign. And for full disclosure, I am going to be speaking at CPAC, and I'm so excited to be there again. I love going to CPAC. I love the people that come to CPAC, the energy that's there, what it fills the room. I'm excited that President Donald Trump is going to be speaking at CPAC again. You did say surprises, though, Matt. So is there anything, any hint? I know I'm going to try to drag it out of you, of what some of those surprises might be. Is there anything you can break here on the Sarah Carter show?
Oh, God, I'm trying to think. Well, first of all, you just broke news because it's not public yet that the president's coming, but I think it's a bad secret, you know?
It is. It's all over the place.
That he likes to go. But, all I can say is we're going to make more room for conservatives in the room and probably a little less room for people in the media, unlike yourself, Sarah.
Oh, that's great to hear. What, you're not inviting CNN? You're not inviting MSNBC? I thought Rachel Maddow was going to be like a centerpiece.
Let me tell you, we're not only allowing all of them to come, we want them to come because I think one of the great things about CPAC is people in the media come assuming that it's kind of a hate fest.
Right.
And then they also assume it's a bunch of guys who just look like me. And they show up and they realize, my gosh, where did all these young people come from?
Right.
Where did all these kind of happy, normal people from around the country, where did they come from? And they expect us all to have our swastikas on our shoulders. And they realize that we have nothing to do with any of that crap that they peddle. And it's a place, we don't believe in being safe spaces and being triggered and all that. But there is something nice about hanging out with mostly people who agree with you, who are just trying to do what's right for their country.
Well, and especially in a time where we see so much unity. But I was just looking down at my laptop, and I have to ask Mercedes this because it's so, for me, it's kind of hilarious. It's really sad, though, in a way, Mercedes. There's a story on Politico right now, and it's about Amy Klobuchar as well as Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Tom Steyer as well were unable to name Mexico's president during a Nevada candidate forum in Las Vegas. They were asked, like, in separate televised interviews. This is on Telemundo. I mean, so you can imagine the blowback, because Telemundo is one of the most watched, by the way, news channels in the world, because there's so many people that speak Spanish, and I don't think our American audience realizes this. So can you imagine? I just say, go for AMLO, right? What was your thoughts on that? I mean,
First of all, I would say it's bad staff work. One, two, going into and talking with any of these Spanish language networks. I do a lot of the interviews with them.
Yes, you do.
Is they're going to ask you that one of the first, they always ask about immigration, and they're, and obviously Mexico is one of our most important trading partners, especially after the passage of USMCA. So to not be able to name the president of Mexico is just, you know, it's a disappointment. I'm not surprised, though. I think that this is, these guys are trying to, like, find their way to get some sort of delegates to win the nomination. But in understanding any sort of foreign policy issues, I think that they're in a very weakened position. And I will tell you, I mean, you know, I was able to work at the White House during the time that we were working on USMCA, and the president spoke to the Mexican president, Obrador, several times, and he was, and, you know, they have a very good relationship, and Mexico has really been able to work closely with the U.S. on these issues of securing the border, on the migration mitigation protocol, which would basically, if an illegal alien is trying to request asylum here in the United States, that they would have to stay in Mexico while their asylum papers are being processed.
Right.
I mean, the Mexican government also worked with us closely to make sure that there would be more police and more security at the border. And again, we've developed a very good relationship with the Mexican government. And that really is due to President Trump. And, you know, he was the first one to say, we're going to have to put tariffs on Mexico if they don't play nice with us and help us out on securing the border, because it was so chaotic. And now what we've seen is apprehensions are down considerably. Yesterday we were with Acting Secretary, Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, and, you know, he's done a remarkable job with Ken Cuccinelli to ensure that we're able to control the situation that's happening at the border, along with Mark Morgan. And it's really because they've done this solely through executive powers. No help from the members of Congress and the Democrats who want open borders.
Which is incredible. And I think that's going to be a huge platform for the Republicans, particularly coming into 2020, because it means so much to the American people when you think about immigration policy. But also for the listeners out there, this means a lot to the country of Mexico and to Manuel López Obrador. That's his name, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. That is the president of Mexico.
Maybe they couldn't name all of his names.
Yeah, because he has a lot of them. That's why I say stick with AMLO, and then everybody's fine. But you brought up such a great
point. Sounds so good.
Oh, say it one more time. Say it.
Obrador.
It's perfect. That's what we're looking for. So this is very important, because we have a huge, base here, Hispanic base. We've seen for some time now, at least over the last 2 years, we've seen a real shift in the Black community, in the African-American community, move towards President Trump. We've seen leaders arise out, Republican conservative leaders, Candace Owens being one of them, and so many more, that are coming out and speaking to young people and saying, look, you don't have to be a Democrat. You can be anything you want. Don't let anybody define you. And Matt, are you seeing that with CPAC as well? Are you seeing maybe more and more minorities coming forward and saying, wait, I think the conservative movement has something for me here?
Well, it's funny because Mercy and I gave a speech the other day, and there was an African-American gentleman who I talked to. We had a great little conversation, and then next thing I know, Mercy said, yeah, I talked to him too, and he wants to help on the campaign. So anecdotally, we have these experiences all the time, as I'm sure you do. And as far as the CPAC attendees are concerned, you know, what the great thing about CPAC, Sarah, is I always laugh about this when they talk about like straw polls and stuff, is it's a great example of democracy, because literally you go on your laptop and you get your ticket.
Yeah.
So you go to conservative.org to get your ticket. And literally, there's not that many left. But my point is, when you get there and look around, and you'll do it again this year as one of our speakers, you'll see the diversity of our coalition. Look, not everybody who comes to CPAC is a Republican. Not everybody who comes to CPAC looks like they just walked off the golf course. Not everybody who comes to CPAC looks like they walked off K Street. It is all different kinds of people showing up in their cowboy hats. people coming from the major cities where they see brokenness of government. So you'll see a great diversity both in the speakers and in those who attend. But what I love about our agenda at CPAC is we really, although we want to make sure we're picking up new voices in our coalition, and it really is a coalition of people, we want to also pick out just the best people. And I do think you and Mercy can both speak to this. People who are from minority populations are offended by the idea of being the black person or the brown person or the woman or whatever. They just want to have their unique voice in the conversation being selected because their voice brings truth.
Absolutely. And that's what I was going to ask you, Mercedes. But I know I've got to let you guys go in a minute or two because you're on your vacation. I don't want to take up, and your kids are going to be so mad at me if I keep talking. They'll just be like, Mom, are you going to get off the phone? But
you know the feeling.
I do know the feeling. I know it.
I don't even think we really take a vacation. This is like our 3 hours just to get away for just a little bit. Just
right.
Some fresh air.
So I can't tell you how much I appreciate you just taking that time to be with us here today and talk to us about this. But you're part of the outreach to the Hispanic community. My family, I mean, I used to watch Telemundo all the time and Univision with my grandmother and my mom and everyone else.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're reaching out. What are you seeing? Because I don't think a lot of people realize how intricate our community is. Not everybody agrees on everything, but we're basically conservatives at heart. I mean, a lot of churchgoers, a lot of the same beliefs, you know, hard workers believe in independence, entrepreneurship. And what are you seeing now that you're out there doing the outreach to the various, different breakdown in the Hispanic community?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's organic. I mean, I think that there's a part of this. I mean, I think about Alex, who's our landscaper, who's become a friend of ours. And, you know, he came in yesterday with a bunch of Trump little pins. And he told me, he goes, I've ordered 100 hats. I'm giving them away. Like, he is, it's just not about, like, I support the candidate. It is about being active, right? It's about the enthusiasm piece of this. And another thing that we are starting to see, it's happened in Texas, for example, is that you're talking about the 25% of the people who are going to the rallies are Democrats. You know, that's significant. It's the president is starting to penetrate into what would be these Democrats, these independents, and they're disgruntled because they're seeing their Democrat Party going far left. And then I think what you see with the Hispanic voters, and look, I think we have a long way to go on the Hispanic voter front, is the fact that we are getting those Hispanics who really are working very hard. They're seeing their businesses take off because of the Trump economy, and they have more money in their pocket. They love this concept of school choice, something that the Democrats keep trying to not make happen. And the president is a champion for school choice, and the Democrats are school choice deniers. And we know that school choice would benefit Hispanic students tremendously, as they do black students. So, I mean, I think when you talk about economy, when you talk about school choice, when you talk about what the president's doing to ensure that America doesn't become a socialist country and is a defender of democracy and freedom, those are messages that resonate with the Hispanic community. Now, as you know, Sarah, Hispanic community is not monolithic.
Right.
You have the Cubans, the Venezuelans, the Nicaraguans, the Mexicans, and they're all going to care about different issues. So part of this is making sure that we're taking the right message, to the right community, and being able to talk about the inroads that we've made in terms of really the president really creating an economy that's benefiting so many Americans and so many individuals in these communities.
And I agree with you, Mercedes, that actions speak louder than words. And that's what we're actually seeing through this presidency. We're actually seeing actions and change within the communities. And when people have more money in their pocket, and when they have businesses and they're entrepreneurs and they're given that opportunity, they feel like they've now taken ownership of their life and they can do something with their life, which under the Democrats and the Democratic platform, sorry to say, I have not heard one thing that tells me, okay, we're out there to help you help yourself. We're going to create policies that are going to make life better for you and your families. And I'm going to give this last question up to Matt, and then you guys can both say goodbye and enjoy your whole day. But Matt, what do you think right now, looking forward to November 2020, is going to be the biggest I think policy issues or issues for the campaign, and I'll give that to you too, Mercedes, because I know you'll have a lot to say there, that we need to be looking at as November approaches. What is it going to be that we're going to be focused on, and what is it that President Trump will move forward?
Let me give you two answers to that very quickly. Number one, incumbent presidents who are part of a vibrant, growing economy are rewarded by Americans because Americans are very practical. A former American president once said, the business of America is business. And I think that's really true. And increasingly under Donald Trump, that's small business. That's mom and pop businesses. That's so typically and wonderfully American. But the second answer I'll give you, Sarah, is I think the ultimate swing constituency, back to your conversation of diversity, the ultimate swing constituency in this election, I believe, is the African-American vote. It's going to determine who, besides Joe Biden, who's their first choice, is going to get this Democratic nomination. And I think for Donald Trump, they are going to come out for him in record numbers we haven't seen since Dwight Eisenhower ran for president. Because, you know, African-Americans in this country used to be Republican because Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party was responsible for abolition, prosecuting the Civil War, the Civil Rights Amendments to the Constitution. And, you know, the Republican Party kind of bungled that relationship over the years. And I think it's coming back. And so I think keep an eye on that African-American vote, not just in the Democratic primary, but in the general election. They can determine who the next president is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And Mercedes, do you agree with that? Or do you think that, I mean, like we're seeing independents as well and Democrats also kind of fill in that gap too with the African-American vote?
So I think it is really one of our areas that we are honing in terms of the Black community. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about there. We always talk about the economy, the benefits this has for the African-American vote, as well as criminal justice reform, an issue that impacts many in the community, and the fact that the president was a champion on criminal justice reform. So I think the president, we feel we're in a strong position to bring in more Blacks into our party and also to support the president this upcoming election. I mean, the energy is there. I will tell you, as we mentioned earlier, just going out, just two of the states that we were just in the last 2 weeks. I mean, those people literally in the Iowa caucus, while the Democrats were having a mess, we literally went to go speak at events that were standing room only. They didn't even really need to go because there wasn't really an Iowa, there was, what you would say is, right, as an incumbent president, he doesn't have to worry about that. But they really feel, Americans feel that they're losing their country if the Democrats were to take power, that they would lose everything they value, meaning their religion, their patriotism, their freedoms. And they're very concerned of a government coming in and being the one telling them what they should and should not do. And that is very disturbing and taking away their individual freedoms. And I think that's a very disturbing prospect for these American voters, and it's why they love Donald Trump. They want him to win, and they're going to do everything they can to go out there on Election Day. And our goal from now to Election Day is to expand that base and bring in diverse voters who are saying, these Democrats, they're too liberal, they're too out there. They're extreme on every issue, and I can't vote for them.
Couldn't agree with you more. Mercedes and Matt, thank you so much for spending some of your vacation time with me on the road, on the way to the farmhouse. Kids, I have set your parents free. They will not answer the phone anymore. I promise you that. No, I'm just kidding. But they will. They have given our time, some time here for our listeners, and we're so thankful. Thank you so much, Mercedes and Matt. I hope you guys have a great day.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sarah. God bless.
That's big news. So we're going to have President Donald Trump at CPAC again this year. This is so exciting. I'm so excited about it. Anyways, I'm going to play a clip right now. Adam, I would love for you to play the clip of President Trump at last year's CPAC. He could be breaking more news at CPAC. This is what he did last year.
Unfortunately, you put the wrong people in a couple of positions. And they leave people for a long time that shouldn't be there. And all of a sudden, They're trying to take you out with bullshit. Okay.
That's gonna be great. I mean, if we could get him to talk like that again this year, I mean, that would be awesome.
Get him on the show. Let's get him on the show.
I would love to have President
Can
Donald Trump on this
our
show.
Sarah
in studio. Carter, that would be even more amazing.
So get our Sarah Carter listeners to tweet at the real Donald Trump. Come on, Sarah's show.
Yes, that would be awesome.
Let's do that.
Okay, we're going to have that. We're going to do that. We'll put in a request. We'll see if we can get him on the show. I think it would be amazing. So remember, CPAC is February 26th through 29th at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center right out here in Maryland. Yes.
I've DJed so many events there.
Oh, see, it's
beautiful.
It's a great place to be. I hear it is completely sold out. Not sure, though, if you go online and you try to get some tickets, I'm sure you might be able, you could squeeze in maybe. Maybe there could be some kind of, I don't know, are there people out there selling tickets, like scalping them in front of the Gaylord? I don't know. Does that happen?
Jenny, are we scalping?
I don't know. Jenny might be out there with some tickets. Again, that's February 26th through 29th at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center. We broke news here at the Sarah Carter Show. Donald Trump will be speaking at CPAC. This is so exciting. So it was a rumor. Now it's confirmed. Confirmed here. I want to do something like we always do on the show. We go to our listeners, our readers on Twitter, and I want to hear what you all have to say about Lisa Page. Now, just so I could set the scene for those of you who don't know, Lisa Page is the former FBI lawyer who was having an affair with the FBI special agent Peter Strzok. Remember, the whole thing that broke was because we got a handle on all of their text messages between each other, mostly about their plans and their loathing and hate for President Donald Trump. Also, how much they hate Walmart shoppers and that they can smell them. So I shop at Walmart. I know everybody here does. I mean, Adam shops at Walmart.
All over it.
Jenny's at Walmart. We love Walmart. So, but that's when everything came out on the Russia hoax. And now that Andrew McCabe basically got to walk, so the DOJ... let me start here. Andrew McCabe lied over and over again. He was interviewed 4 times by investigators with the inspector general. He was caught 3 times. Can we play this? Is this Andy McCabe?
Yeah, we do have
Let's
that.
Do,
I don't
this.
Wanna, do you want to finish the thought?
Well, yeah, let me finish the thought and we'll go right to it. Basically, Andy McCabe was caught lying 3 times to federal investigators, and now he's been allowed to walk. So Lisa Page basically put out this tweet saying, I'm done being quiet, on her shirt on Valentine's Day with a glass of wine in her hand, smiling. And the message was to Andy. She said, "Cheers, Andy!" Exclamation point. Let's listen to Andy McCabe.
"I really am looking forward to celebrating with my family and friends. It's been so unbelievably tense and just such an incredible pressure on all of us. And we're all very, very happy. And I'm just so glad my kids don't have to live with this anymore."
Okay, just stop it. Just stop it because it's just so disgusting. Okay, so this is a 2-tier justice system. This is what happens when senior level officials are allowed to lie, try to coup a presidency, and then just walk away. And just walk away from it like nothing, right? Now, what I've heard was that William Barr was not happy about this at all, that it fell apart on the grand jury scale by Lou, who was in charge of this, overseeing this and ensuring that Andrew McCabe would have been prosecuted. But the whole thing fell apart during the grand jury. Now, I'm not sure what happened there, but for him to go on CNN and talk about celebrating when they ripped our nation apart, lied to federal investigators. And by the way, if you and I lied, we would go to jail. I just want you to know that this is a totally different world we're in right now. And if John Durham doesn't do anything to hold people accountable and indict people for what's happened to this country over the last 3 years, something is seriously wrong. But now we're going to go to the funny stuff because we don't want to be serious the whole time. We had a lot of responses. I retweeted out, and so did Jenny Terror. And Adam, you're going to crack up at this. But we retweeted basically Lisa Page's tweet, congratulating Andy McCabe for lying and getting away with it. And this is what our listeners and readers had to say about that.
So if you guys want to write into us, we're on Twitter at Sarah Carter DC, and we have a few responses to Miss Lisa Page's shirt and picture she posted on Valentine's Day. One person says, by the name Rosie, says he's married.
He was married when they were having an affair. Isn't that nice?
Then I have someone who altered the shirt. It says, "Will alter 302s for fun."
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. I actually want that t-shirt.
Then we have Charles, finally. He says, "Laugh and drink while you can. Durham is just getting started, and the bar tab is going to come due soon."
Wow. So we've got Charles. Yeah, tequila. It's kind of a fun Latin music. It's going with like...
Sarah, how do you drink your tequila? Straight?
You got to drink your tequila straight. But I got to be honest, I have not had tequila since I was in college. I had a bad experience.
Okay, I don't know. Maybe those Fox News nights.
No tequila for me. And if I say vodka, people are going to think I'm Russian. Hey, what about YouTube?
Yeah, YouTube, if you want to see our show, I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who enjoy listening to us. But if you ever want to watch us, you can over at YouTube. Just find Sarah Carter's page. One of the comments came in from last week's episode, and I actually want to pull this music down because we had Andrew Pollack on, the Parkland
yes.
father. And
great.
Debbie writes in, "Thank you, Sarah, for letting him speak uninterrupted and for the love and respect that you showed him. I learned so much from this interview, and now I want to get involved. I have a sixth grader, and this terrifies me. God bless Andrew for working so hard for my child." So, Jenny, do you have that where they can go if they want to get involved in what we were talking about last show?
Right. So the technology that he spoke about is called IntraLogic, and people can go to ilsny.com to find out more about that technology.
Perfect.
Wow, that's incredible. ilsny.com. If you need to find out anything about what Andrew Pollack was talking about on the show, that's so important, and I'm so glad I heard that, because that was such a difficult interview to get through, because I know as a parent it has to sit with him, rip him apart every single day.
So many right? of those comments just coming on. I mean, powerful episode, my thoughts and prayers, obviously. So yeah, no, it was hard to get through, but I think it was meaningful.
It was absolutely meaningful, and it was in memory of his daughter Meadow Pollack, who died at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School when she was killed by this horrific action taken by Nicholas Cruz. And this is her father's way of actually changing people's lives and saving our children's lives.
And he reached out to you, right? And said,
"Oh, he did. Yeah, he did. He reached out. He thanked me for the episode. I told him I'd love to bring him back on. I want to keep following his story. I want to help get the word out. I want us to help him save lives. Let's save our kids' lives. Let's do what's right in this country. We always do. This is America. You know I love you. We love you here at the Sarah Carter Show. And we want you to come back for more. We got so many great stories coming up in the next few weeks here at the Sarah Carter Show. Thank you so much for being with us. I love you, America. Thank you. This is going to be an awesome year. We are going to make a difference. And we are some of the luckiest people on planet Earth. Thank you for joining us. We're taking the story back.